Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we wanted to talk about some horrendous environmental happenings that are taking place in the country, and also a new report that was released on Sunday that shows that the rates of sea level rise in a hotspot along the U.S. Atlantic coast are increasing about 3 to 4 times more than the global average and could increase the vulnerability of coastal cities to flooding and beaches and wetlands to deterioration. Of course, there have been those horrendous fires in Colorado. Our guest is in Colorado right now and has seen three of those fires. Floods encompassing almost the whole state of Florida, terrible floods in Duluth, Superior, and Minnesota. And we thought we would ask, what's going on with all of this? And so that's exactly what we're going to do this hour of the program. George Stone is our guest. He's an instructor of natural science at the Milwaukee Area Technical College and is co-founder and chair of the Green Energy Summit in Milwaukee. He teaches a variety of courses in the earth sciences, including earth science, general geology, weather fundamentals, climate change fundamentals, and energy and nature, technology, and society. He serves as co-chair of the MATC District Sustainability and Facilities Core Committee, and he became interested in climate change ever since he took a graduate course in marine geology at the University of Miami. During the past 3 decades, his professional focus has been on the interrelationships of energy and climate. George, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, good morning, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, pleasure to have you here. Why don't you start with Colorado, where firefighters, every night we see these horrendous fires taking place and people evacuating. You have seen some of the fires from where you sit, haven't you?
Yes, we have. We have a cabin just outside Estes Park near Rocky Mountain National Park. And we had one fire start here just last Saturday, which we didn't know about. We were driving into town and saw this big column of smoke and discovered a fire had started just about 15 minutes before, apparently due to an electrical short, and it just exploded because the conditions are so unusually favorable for fire, or you might say extremely dangerous, and very high temperatures, prolonged heat wave, drought conditions, very low humidity, and high winds. Just a terrible combination, and fires are springing up all over. Last night, we went down to Boulder to see a panel discussion on climate change, and as we were driving in, we saw a new fire up on the mountain, a column of smoke. It had just started about an hour or two beforehand, and so the conditions are so dangerous that and this one was lightning started, so it's very, very bad. Colorado has a huge fire, a record-breaking fire a little farther north, about 20 miles north of where we are, west of Fort Collins, where Colorado State University is. And that has burned about 135 square miles, 87,000 acres. It's been burning for 2.5 weeks. So it's a very serious, there are about 12 major fires throughout the state, and not just in Colorado, but also in New Mexico and Utah and throughout the West. It's a dangerous situation.
When you went to that climate change conference in Boulder, did the fires come up as a point of discussion and climate change being perhaps responsible for this, or is this just the way things are in Colorado?
Well, no, it did come up during the question and answer period in the panel, and this has been a record-breaking heat wave for the Denver area and for much of the eastern half of the state. Denver has set record-breaking heat temperatures for 5 days in a row. They broke their all-time record or tied their all-time record of 105 degrees, and this is still in June. And temperatures well over 100 degrees down in the southeastern part of the state, temperatures of 110, 108, and very, very low humidities and high winds. And so these extreme weather conditions and extreme weather and climate events are, in general, a result of planetary warming or global warming. Yeah, there's not much question about that.
So when you look at what's going on in Florida, what happened in Duluth, Minnesota, what's happening along the Atlantic coast, the real hot weather that sort of comes and goes, but when it's hot, it is hot. That all of those are related to climate change?
Yes, almost certainly. Now, one thing to remember about the warming, the planet is warming. There's no question about that. The temperature data show that. The ice around the planet is melting. That shows that. And as the planet warms, the surface of the ocean warms, and then it evaporates more moisture into the atmosphere. So we have about 4% more humidity, more water vapor, I should say, in the atmosphere now than we did 40 years ago. And with more water vapor in the atmosphere, we're going to get more extreme precipitation events. That's predicted by the computer models, and it's been happening and all around the world, extreme precipitation events, also extreme temperature events. And so the result, the impact of global warming is more extreme weather and climate events of all kinds around the globe.
There was a report, I'm sure you're familiar with it, released earlier this week that looked at sea level rise in this hot spot along the U.S. Atlantic coast. Evidently, I didn't know this was happening, but the Boston Globe is reporting that Massachusetts has been preparing for sea level rise for some time now. Two questions here. Is this something that we have expected, and this is the first scientific report? And number two, are communities making plans for what's going to happen when the sea level goes up significantly?
Well, that's a great question. Yes, we have expected it. It's been predicted by the computer climate models, simply because as the planet warms up, the ice melts, and it's the glaciers on the land that add new water. When they melt, they add new water to the oceans and raise the level of the ocean. Also, as the ocean water itself warms, it expands, thermal expansion, and so that contributes to rising sea level. So we've known that sea level is going to rise. We've got a lot more measurements now, such as those that were published in Abby Salinger, that's the USGS report, and his group. So it's not a surprise at all, and in fact, not only are all the coastlines of the world threatened by this, but many of the low-lying island nations and nations in on deltas, such as Louisiana or Bangladesh, these areas are threatened by rising sea level and may force large mass evacuations. And there are many islands in the Pacific and in the Indian Ocean, for example, such as the Maldives, which only are a few feet above sea level in their highest places. And so when sea level rises a little bit, they're in grave danger. And they lose their fresh water supply. And also, when storms occur, which they are occurring more frequently and more intensely, then they do more damage because the sea level is already higher and the storms come farther ashore. So this is a worldwide problem, not just along coastlines, but especially in low-lying island areas and delta nations.
And have we been doing anything about it?
No, we've been ignoring the problem. You know, there was a major conference that just concluded in Rio de Janeiro. It marked the 20th anniversary of the Earth Summit, which was held down there in June of 1992, to much publicity and acclaim. And here, 20 years later, they had a follow-up conference, and virtually no progress has been made since that time. All they managed to accomplish was to reaffirm goals that had been established 20 years ago. One of the main problems, of course, is competition with the economy, with the worldwide economy in the sorry state that it is right now. Countries are reluctant to put any more restrictions or regulations on manufacturing or on any human activity that increases the carbon footprint. And so we've made very little progress in reducing the greenhouse gas emissions that cause global warming. And so the problem is becoming more acute because as time goes by, it's going to be harder and harder to control in the long run, and it's going to cost everybody in the world, all taxpayers, a lot more money in the long run to adapt to the impacts, which are already being felt around the world, but also to mitigate and try to prevent truly catastrophic impacts in the future.
I've been thinking about, I watch the news all the time, and I've been thinking about how much of our news has been dominated by the fires in Colorado, the horrible flooding in Florida, the horrible flooding in Duluth, Minnesota, the horrible hot weather, the extreme dryness, or floods. You know, it's one or the other. It seems as though our news is more and more dominated by these kinds of stories. Once we keep getting newscast after newscast, don't you think a lot of people will say, what the heck's going on here?
Well, yes, they are. And I hope they make the connection. And we scientists need to do a far better job of communicating exactly what's happening to the public at large and to the policymakers, because we're not going to be able to do anything without political will. And the political will comes from public awareness and public will. And I think when we start putting it in dollars and cents of how much this is actually costing people, you know, we can say, oh, well, the government has to, or the Homeland Security or the Federal Emergency Management, they have to spend them. Well, that's taxpayer money that they're spending, and it's costing more and more and more all the time. And you're quite right about recent events. I mean, just think back over the past few years. We had a record-breaking year for tornadoes last year. We've just had extreme events. Russia had its all-time greatest heat wave, and a lot of people died of heat stroke a few years before that. In Western Europe and France in particular, a very prolonged extreme heat wave. These kind of weather and climate events have been coming more frequently and more severely all around the world, different types at different times in different places, but the frequency and the intensity is greater and greater. I co-chaired a technical session on extreme weather and climate events at the Geological Society of America's annual meeting last year up in Minneapolis, and there was well-documented evidence showing the increase in the frequency and intensity of these extreme weather and climate events as predicted by the climate change models. You put more heat into the Earth's system, you put more moisture, more water vapor into the atmosphere, and that's what results. And we've just simply got to stop putting our head in the sand and started recognizing and addressing this problem, because it's becoming more and more and more serious.
George Stone, a champion of energy education for more than a decade, he teaches a number of courses in the earth sciences at MATC. He's also co-founder and chair of the Green Energy Summit in Milwaukee. Here's our phone number for you to join this conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and you can also leave messages on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. What do you make of all of these events, horrendous events that are taking place, the heat and the fires and the floods and the rising of the sea level? Do you worry about all of this? Do you think that we're taking action? Do you think that we need to be doing more than we are? Does it change the way that you live? You know, I'm thinking today in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin, we got another 2 days of it being very, very hot, and it's hard for it to be really hot. You have to take special precautions, and at some point you say, this isn't right. We got to do something about it. Have we reached that point? All right, we have a lot of phone calls coming in. We'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Greg in Kenosha. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I wondered if your guest could just comment on the need for scientists to remain calm and be very careful to stick to the facts, given the gravity of the situation and what I would assume is a human temptation to make pronouncements that, in fact, aren't always completely based on the scientific record or on scientific truth as we best understand it. I sound a little like a skeptic, and I don't mean to. I really am not a skeptic on this issue, but I think there is some evidence that sometimes scientists, in their eagerness to convince the public to be concerned about something, occasionally concerns are overstated, and that can really kind of blow up in your face in the end, and in terms of credibility. I wonder if your guest would just
and Greg,
speak to that concern.
Yeah, and just to clarify where you are on this, what do you think has been overstated?
Oh, I'm not saying anything in regards to this. I would say, for instance, certain dire pronouncements made in the past about something like population growth. I mean, pronouncements about by such and such a date this disastrous situation will be upon us. I mean, certain pronouncements that, in fact, I'm not saying there's not a population problem, for instance, but I mean, certain pronouncements were made decades ago by certain authors or scientists that, you know, proved to be overstated. I mean, I just think it's a human condition that we're all subject to it, including scientists, and I'm not a skeptic on this issue of climate change at all. But
all right, George.
Well, that's an excellent question, Greg. There's always that danger, and I suppose there might be a very, very small percentage, just a few individuals who might go a little bit over the line and exaggerate in order to prove their point. But that's a rare, rare exception. The consensus case on climate change, man-caused climate change, we call it anthropogenic or human-caused, in other words, global warming, the consensus among climate scientists, the people who know the data and know the subject best, is overwhelming. There was a paper published 2 years ago which surveyed over 2,000 climate scientists around the world, and the consensus that climate change, global warming is happening, and that the combustion of fossil fuels and other human activities, but primarily the combustion of fossil fuels is the principal cause, was overwhelming, more than 97%. Now, you try to get 97% agreement in any group about anything. And the reason there's such overwhelming consensus and agreement on this is because, like good science, it's based on measurements. It's based on observations and data, which can be examined and reproduced by anyone. So the concern about human-caused climate change now is based on overwhelming evidence from virtually every branch of science around the world, 30,000 data sets, and so there's really no question about it. Now, let me make this point about skeptics. Skeptics play a very, very important role because they cause the scientists to go back and prove their case and reveal their data and show their reasoning more carefully so that it's really clear. Think about the criteria that we use in our justice system. In a civil case, it's a preponderance of the evidence. That's the criterion what must be met in a civil case. In a criminal case, of course, everyone knows it's beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, those criteria have been met and surpassed as far as man-made climate change is concerned. But the skeptics, they play the role of making us make sure that we present the data and that we present our case very well. Just as you might say, the defense attorney causes the prosecution to present the case and have a better case, because without that tension between the two sides, the case might not be as well made. I would say this, in conclusion, answering your question, Greg, I think scientists don't say enough. I think scientists have a responsibility to the society that supports them, and that they need to see their responsibility not just through the narrow prism of their own research, but in a broader view. I think scientists have, when it comes to a case like this, which threatens the well-being of humanity, not just in the United States, but around the world, and especially the poorer, it's a matter of justice and intergenerational justice that we owe our descendants. Scientists have a strong responsibility to communicate their case, their evidence, clearly to the public and to the policymakers, and I don't think they're doing enough of that. I don't think enough scientists are involved in communicating the evidence of this pending catastrophe. And the longer we put it off, the harder it is to mitigate. It's kind of like deferred maintenance on your car. If you don't service your car, if you don't get it lubed and change the oil and take care of the vehicle, it's going to deteriorate, and in the long run, it's going to cost you a heck of a lot more than it would if you spend a little bit along the way. So I think that's the way we've got to look at this problem. And right now, and there are lots of feedbacks that kick in, natural feedbacks, as the climate warms, and it's potentially going to run away where we won't be able to do anything about it.
Thank you, Greg, for your call. Let's go to Jack in Madison. Hi, Jack.
I would wish that your guests would discuss the methane, the emissions of methane in the Arctic, which apparently is becoming a runaway phenomenon. And I'm wondering, is there really much that we can do about it besides, you know, covering our crops with some kind of sheeting to protect them from the heat, because we're going to be turning into a desert, aren't we?
Some areas will. Yeah, you raise a very, very important point. Carbon dioxide, due primarily to the combustion of fossil fuels, is not the only important greenhouse gas. Excuse me. methane actually is approximately 22 times more effective in absorbing heat than carbon dioxide. And when organic matter decays, such as when the tundra in the Arctic or permanently frozen ground, permafrost areas in the Arctic thaw out, the organic, the vegetative matter primarily in that, when that starts to decay, if there's sufficient oxygen around, then it will form carbon dioxide. But if there's insufficient oxygen, then it will form methane. And a lot of methane is being generated by the thawing of the tundra and the thawing of the permafrost, which is happening all around the Arctic, all the way across. If you look at the size of Eurasia, all across northern Siberia, this is happening. It's happening in northern Canada and Alaska. A serious addition of greenhouse gases. And this is what we call a positive feedback, because as the climate warms, more and more thawing takes place, more release of methane, and that accelerates, in turn, increases the rate of warming. So that's a very serious problem. There are also what are called methane clathrates and methane hydrates, in particular, in the oceans. And as the oceans warm, a lot of that may thaw out and add additional methane. So this is one of the things we're talking about. In order to prevent runaway greenhouse warming, in which the temperature goes up not just 1 or 2 degrees, which is very significant, but 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 degrees, we've got to get started now before it gets out of hand.
Yeah, can you look at certain countries in the world or organizations who are doing the right thing on this issue, who have advocated policies, who have implemented policies, who have gotten the public to understand the science here?
Well, yes, and the European Union and Britain, they have instituted much stricter policies than we have. It's somewhat now with this worldwide economic slump, it's certainly to the detriment of their economies, and they're having to cut back on that because the economy runs on energy, and our principal sources of energy right now still are fossil fuels, that is coal, oil, and natural gas. If we would convert to more renewable sources, and they're doing much, much more of that in Europe and in Britain than we are, and in other parts of the world as well. China, for example, has got a major program in that, but it's such a huge country with such a huge growing economy. They're also building a tremendous number of new coal plants, which is bad. So they're doing both. But if we could convert, the answer to your question is yes, some countries are doing a lot more. But we've all got to do more, and especially the leading economies, which are the United States and China and the burgeoning of the BRIC countries, Brazil, India, Russia, as well as China. They've got to do a lot more, but of course they want their economies to develop as quickly as possible,
sure.
And very often that means using fossil fuels for the energy source. But big changes have to be made, and I must say that this recent conference, Rio Plus 20, which just concluded this past week, was a big disappointment, hardly any progress. And they have an annual conference called the Conference of Parties. It's under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And each one of these turns out to be a bigger disappointment than the last. Very little progress being made. And so we need a wake-up call for the planet. This planet is heating up fast, and it may get out of control.
Nick is gone. Sorry, Nick. Let's go to Steve in Monaco. Hi, Steve.
Hi. You'd be really happy to know that both President Obama and Mitt Romney have talked about the importance of getting China on board because they are the main polluter. They don't have the environmental regulations and safeguards that we do as a country. But if you're interested in getting a more mainstream scientific view on, you know, the changing climates and naturally occurring cycles in the coming ice age, you should read a book by Robert Felix called Not by Fire, but by Ice. And, of course, as you know, volcanoes, you know, just a little thing like a natural thing like a volcano can cause more greenhouse than 100 years of car pollution.
That's absolutely untrue. You're misinformed, and I can comment on that in a minute.
Yeah.
And our effect on the planet and, you know, cows releasing gas. Cows that out in the farmer's field, you know, it's the next thing coming is an ice age.
No, that's not true. I'm a geologist, and I can say with great assurance that what you just said is absolutely untrue. Without any human interference, we might switch back into the next naturally caused ice age cycle in maybe 10,000 years or so. But the impact of the natural cycle, which is very small and very gradual due to astronomical variations in the Earth's orbit and its axis, those are slow and gradual. We know them extremely well, documented from the past. That's not a danger at all. That's a distraction. As far as China goes, that's been used as an excuse, China and India, by the United States, not to do anything. We say that, well, until China does as much as we do, we're not going to do anything. You know, Western Europe and the United States, the Western economies, have created this problem since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. The amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere due to combusting fossil fuels has increased 40% in just 200 years. Now, in terms on the geological scale, that is an incredibly enormous rate. It's totally outside anything natural, and that's what's created the problem. So we created the problem. We have a major responsibility to addressing it and to showing leadership. Why is it, I pose this question to you, why is it that the United States, which has led the world in conservation and environmental action for well over 150 years, dating back to Abraham Lincoln, that great Republican president, the first one who granted federal land to the state of California so they could set aside Yosemite. 8 years later, Yellowstone became the first national park under Ulysses S. Grant, another Republican president. Then at the turn of the century, the first decade of the 20th century, Teddy Roosevelt, known as a leader of conservation, established the National Forest System, the National Monument System, greatly increased the number of national parks, right on up through Richard Nixon, who signed the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, Republican presidents all. We have led the world in addressing conservation. We've shown leadership in conservation and preserving our environment, and that came to a screeching halt in the 80s, and now we're an anchor for the world. We're resisting addressing the greatest environmental challenge in human history, and we should be continuing our glorious tradition of leadership in conservation and environment instead of using China as an excuse.
Harry in Madison wants to know, George, how important the oceans are in dealing with climate change.
Oh, they're extremely, extremely important because water has a very high heat content. And so the oceans are an enormous storehouse of heat energy. And we're measuring that. More and more and more heat is being absorbed and stored in the oceans, which means that the changes that are taking place aren't going to go away and can't be reversed right away. They're going to be around for centuries. And we have to prevent the situation from getting much worse. One other thing about the oceans, of course, have dissolved gases in it. The carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere, for example, is also dissolved in the oceans, just like in a carbonated beverage. And everybody knows when your carbonated beverage warms up, it goes flat. And the same thing will happen to the oceans and is happening to the oceans. As the surface of the oceans warms up, the amount of dissolved carbon dioxide it can hold decreases. And so it releases carbon dioxide. It's a great storage or storehouse of carbon dioxide. But as it warms up, it'll release that. That's another positive feedback which will exacerbate the problem. So in sum, the oceans are extremely important. They cover 71% of the Earth's surface. They store an enormous amount of heat, and they store a large amount of carbon dioxide.
We go to Ivy next in Evansville. Hi, Ivy.
Oh, hi. I don't know if this point was brought up, but one of the things that is never mentioned when you talk about, say, alternative energies that people can use is decentralizing that energy. Whenever we talk about wind and why it can't work, we always are talking about these big wind farms and everything, and you know, or big solar power plants. And I really think that it's important to decentralize the energy for several reasons. Because of if something goes wrong in another city, you still have power. Your neighboring city has power. I mean, we're reliant on a few power plants. Like in Omaha last year, one of the nuclear power plants was flooded, and so it affected everybody in this huge area. And if the less we rely on these centralized power plants, the better off we are. And also, if you look at national security, I'd say that, you know, that's another reason.
George.
Oh, well, that's a great point. What is the caller's name?
Ivy.
Ivy, great points, Ivy. As a matter of fact, we are looking at that, and it has been talked about. You raise such a great point. We have in Wisconsin, for example, an organization called Wisconsin Initiative for Distributed Resource, WIDERC. Distributed resources, that would mean not the old model of a big central power plant, such as you're talking about, but having localized generation of electric power by wind or by electrical means or by fuel cells or others. And this is in the national security interest because there's not one big grid system. It's called the microgrid. And there are a strong movement now, and this needs a lot of support, especially in the state of Wisconsin. You know, Wisconsin is a state without any fossil fuels, and so we spend about more than $18 billion a year goes out of state to import fossil fuels or the energy from fossil fuels. The more of that money we could invest within our state, creating new jobs and developing distributed resource from renewable energy, the better. So that's a very important point. And let me pick up on the national security aspect of this. In its quadrennial report published in 2010, the Defense Department, the Pentagon, cited climate change, human-caused climate change, as a major national security threat, as an issue. Because when you have climate change like this, you know, a lot of the people around the world don't have sufficient food supply. They don't have access to safe drinking water. And with climate change, it's reducing the availability of those fundamental life-giving resources. And so it destabilizes the political situation locally in many places around the world, and political instability leads to disruptions and migrations and wars. And so that's why the Pentagon singles out climate change as a serious national security threat. And I hardly think that the Pentagon is, kind of politically motivated. I think they're genuinely concerned about the security of the nation. So that's a very important point. And that's one reason, Ivy, that we have this, and I'm going to get my plug in here now while I get a chance. We have the annual conference in Milwaukee. It's been called the Green Energy Summit. We had our 9th annual last March. This coming March, we've changed the name to the Sustainability Summit, and it will be the 10th annual. And the function of this conference, which is sponsored by a vast array of academic and corporate institutions, is to educate the public and the business community and the investment community to these historic trends and to the opportunities in alternative energy, and especially in renewable energy and energy efficiency and sustainable business practices. Those are so important to conserving energy as well as other resources and to safeguarding our future.
And you've had huge turnouts for those. There is a lot of interest.
Oh, there is. There is. Our very first meeting was held up at in Cleveland, Wisconsin, at Lakeshore Technical College 10 years ago. About 60 people came from the various technical colleges, and then it's increased. We've spread beyond the technical colleges. The University of Wisconsin system is a sponsor, as well as many of the individual campuses. A lot of the private schools like Marquette and Alverno and Concordia, Milwaukee School of Engineering, and a lot of the major corporations, such as Johnson Controls and Kohl's and A.O. Smith and Harley-Davidson, and a lot of the old line Wisconsin companies mm-hmm. are major sponsors of this. And we've had, last year we had over 3,400 attend. It's free for all students. Free. Everybody can register online. Go to sustainabilitysummit.us. But students, most importantly, can register free of charge. They do have to register online, but they can register free of charge. So we get a big turnout, a lot of interest, and we feel that we've been accomplishing our goal of educating the public in general, and also a lot of the business interests and investors as to future possibilities.
Right.
Because with change comes opportunity.
Joe in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. Hi, George. Thank you for your work. I'm a regular attendee of your Green Energy Summits here in Milwaukee.
Good. You mean you've come back more than once?
What's that?
You've come back more than once?
Oh, certainly.
Well, you must have liked it.
Yes, I did.
Good.
Very impressive. In fact, I interviewed Hansen there.
Oh, James Hansen, yeah.
Right. Anyways, let me bounce this off you. I think we have a PR problem here. The fossil fuel industry has a vested interest in refuting the climate change claims, and they can spend major money on PR to spread their message. we're losing the PR war.
That's the problem. And as you point out, last year, Jim Hansen was our keynote speaker in 2009. I just saw him last night down in Boulder, and I invited him to come back for 2013. So I'm hoping that we'll get him back at our next summit, our 10th annual. But in any case, Bill McKibben was our keynoter last year, and he made just the point that you're making. He said that the fossil fuel industry is the most profitable industry in the history of civilization, and they don't want things to change. And so, as you say, they fund all kinds of lobbyists, pour millions and millions and millions into political campaigns. They fund disinformation campaigns about the global climate change problem. And, of course, they don't want to see things change. And it's a very, very tough sell. I mean, it's no different than our political climate in general, where big money is really taking control of our political system. And so you could go beyond the climate change issue, which God knows is important enough, to our democracy in general. I mean, I think our democracy is threatened by the unlimited, in the wake of the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court and its recent decision in the Montana case. It opens the floodgates for unlimited corporatist interests money in political campaigns, hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's corrupting our whole political system, and our democracy itself is in danger. And I'm not kidding about this. I think seriously that we're in danger of drifting into a plutocratic oligarchy. In other words, control of our country by a small, relatively small percentage of extremely wealthy corporations and individuals. And that's impeding and even addressing the problem of climate change. Have you heard either one of the presidential candidates or any of the candidates in the Republican primary debates address or bring up the global warming or the climate change issue? It's like a taboo. Nobody, here it is, the most serious and challenging environmental problem of human history, and nobody even mentions it.
Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. George Stone is our guest this hour. He's instructor of natural science at the Milwaukee Area Technical College, co-founder and chair of the Green Energy Summit in Milwaukee, and has long been concerned about climate change. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and you can also leave messages on Facebook, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. George Stone is our guest. This hour of the program, we're looking at what's going on with the environment, our interest. Well, there's a lot of interest, of course. There is a report that was released this week, done by the U.S. Geological Survey. It was published in Nature Climate Change, and it looked at sea level rise in a hotspot along the U.S. Atlantic coast, increasing about 3 to 4 times more than the global average, and could increase the vulnerability of coastal cities. More flooding, beaches and wetlands could deteriorate. The Boston Globe has been writing about this, and it's been on the news this week, perhaps not as extensively as it should be, but it's been around. Boston Globe has been describing how Massachusetts is preparing for sea level rise by inspecting utility systems, changing codes for development projects in flood zones, and creating incentives not to build in vulnerable areas. I guess we're feeling, many of us, that so many areas are vulnerable right now, and so we were looking at what's going on with Florida and the floods and the heat and the fires in Colorado and sea levels rising. Is it saying to us we got to pay attention to this issue and perhaps take it on in a serious way? Joe in Green Bay, hi.
Hello. A question for Professor Stone about glaciations.
Mm-hmm.
There were, I saw where there were 46 advances and retreats of glaciers in the last 2.6 million years. How do you explain that? And then one other question, what's your take on the Deniers book by Lawrence Stone? Lawrence Stone, thank you.
Well, as far as the multiple glaciations, that's a good point. Those are a result of natural cycles. We normally think of, in just our popular concepts, that the Ice Age was a single event which came to an end about 10 to 15,000 years ago. If you live in Greenland or Antarctica, actually, it hasn't come to an end yet. But in the northern continents, such as North America and the Midwest, the Ice Age came to an end about 12,000 years ago. And we think that that was it. That was one major cooling event, an Ice Age. In actuality, there were many, 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 many fluctuations, as you point out, over the past 2 million-plus years. The modern Ice Age, and it wasn't the only one in Earth's history, but certainly the most recent, during what geologists call the Pleistocene Epoch, this Ice Age was a series of coolings and advances of the glaciers, and then warmings, interglacial periods, and retreat and melting away of the glaciers. And this happened many, many, many times. There are fluctuations in the Earth's orbit. The orbit is not perfectly circular. It's elliptical, and it changes depending upon how near and how far Jupiter is, for example, which is another huge mass in the solar system that attracts the Earth and distorts its orbit. So there are orbital distortions. There are also changes in the tilt of the Earth's axis. The angle of tilt right now is about 23.5 degrees. That's the angle of tilt between the axis and the plane of the orbit, or the plane of the ecliptic, as it's called, which the Earth follows going around the sun, revolving around the sun. Then there's also a wobble of the Earth's axis called precession, just like a top. If you spin a top, as it slows down, its axis begins to wobble. So there are these different variations, and all of these produce different intensities of solar radiation, because the amount of heat coming from the sun's radiation that reaches the Earth's surface depends upon the angle. The higher the angle, the more concentrated the energy is, and so forth. Well, mathematical calculations with all this astronomical data show that there are fluctuations. There's a 100,000-year cycle, a 40,000-year cycle, and a 23,000-year cycle. And these variations account for all of the repeated glaciations. Now, the Ice Age started probably after the continents had moved more into higher latitudes and had colder climates. Once the climate begins to cool, then more carbon dioxide dissolves in the oceans, and that reduces the amount of that greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, and that greatly enhances the cooling trend. And similarly, once the climate starts to warm, the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere increases because the oceans release it as they go flat, so to speak. So this is all well documented, and these changes are slow and gradual over a long period of time. What's happening now is incredibly at a much, much, much higher scale of time. It's much, much faster, the human-caused climate change that we're experiencing right now.
Let's talk about what's going on in Massachusetts, where I was reading earlier they're inspecting utility systems, changing codes for projects in flood zones, and creating incentives not to build in vulnerable areas. Does it make sense for us to concentrate on doing those kinds of things, how to deal with what is likely to happen with global warming, rather than putting our resources in trying to prevent the warmth and weather changes?
Well, that's an excellent question, Kathleen. I think it's not either or. We need to do both. The one is called adaptation. A certain amount of global warming and its impacts are inevitable no matter what we do. For example, carbon dioxide is a very stable molecule in the atmosphere. The average carbon dioxide molecule will stick around for more than a century, and many of them may stick around for a millennium. So what's going on now is going to be with us for a long time, and so a certain amount of adaptation is called for. The other approach is to try to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions so that we don't have extreme global warming in the future, and that's called mitigation, and that's what we really need to concentrate, but we need to do both. Now, Massachusetts is taking an intelligent, mature approach to this. They recognize that it's happening, and they're making provisions to protect their coastlines. But that's not true in all states. For example, in North Carolina, the Senate there, the state Senate, recently passed a bill forbidding state scientists. Now get this. Here's politics reaching into research. Forbidding state scientists to mention any extrapolations of future sea level rise that are not linear based on what's happened in the past. Well, of course, predictions of future sea level rise are not linear. They're exponential because the rate of rise is going to increase dramatically as the ice melts around the world, the glacial ice. And so what they've done is they've tried to muzzle the scientific research so that the effects of global warming are not allowed to be published. Well, the House in North Carolina got so much political flack after the Senate passed this bill that they came to a new compromise, and they've just had a 3-year moratorium on publishing any projections of sea level rise until more research is done. But this is happening in other states too. The reason is that those coastal properties have a high real estate value, and those coastal properties and developers pay taxes, property taxes, and the local counties, the coastline counties, don't want their developers to stop. They don't want to lose their tax revenues, and so once again, it's an economic consideration versus reality of the threat of rising sea levels. And so Massachusetts has taken the enlightened and the practical approach, I would say, dealing with reality, that's not true of a lot of other states. And let me just point out quickly, the National Research Council just the week before came out with a major report predicting at least 3 feet of sea level rise in California. That was another major report that just
And
came
what
out.
About in Colorado where there are fires? Do we need to come up with strategies to deal with that? Or in Duluth, Minnesota, where there are floods? Or in Florida, where the whole state is flooded? Or in other parts of the country where we have droughts?
Well, I mean, it's very, very tough to do. You can have better flood protection, we don't know where the next flood is going to be. We've had record-breaking floods and rainstorms in different parts of the country, and the trouble with this is it kind of skips around. It's not always the worldwide global warming increases the probability, and these are generalities and abstractions that are hard to grasp sometimes, but it increases the probability of these extreme events happening. I remember, I think it was 2 years ago in July, we had 200-year storms in Milwaukee within 9 days.
Oh, I remember those well.
And my basement got flooded both times, as did a lot of other folks. So it just increases the probability. On that basis, we just have to address the problem worldwide.
Milan in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I'm in the agricultural development and consultant business, and we in the upper Midwest are benefiting greatly from global warming. We are pushing our planting limits further and further north, going with longer season crops, getting greater timber production, and we're wasting money on things like rebuilding New Orleans, which should be abandoned. And I think these are the issues that we really should take into account, that there are benefits from global warming, and the benefits are worldwide. Canada.
Wasting money on rebuilding a city where hundreds of thousands of people live. Well, those my priorities are not the same as yours, and your generalization is overbroad. I mean, we've had long stretches of drought, which have severely affected agriculture in Wisconsin.
Agriculture has increased every single year for the last 30 years.
We've had prolonged periods of drought, which have severely hurt some segments of the agricultural
community. Some segments,
community.
Correct.
Your
we can
general,
deal with
your
drought.
Generalization
we can't deal
is overbroad. And I think your comment
well,
about
we can only hear one
I think
person.
Your comment about New Orleans is contemptible.
We need to move to another caller. Thanks, Milan, for the call. Daryl in Bloomington. Hi.
Yeah, according to Senator Corburn, a Republican from Oklahoma, there is $3.6 trillion in the private sector. And there are many ways that the private sector can take care of this problem. And if we don't do something about this problem, future generations, your great-grandchildren and so forth, will not have a future. I mean, this thing is going to get so bad if we don't address it that it
That's
will
right.
be life-threatening to humanity.
That's
There's
right.
There's all kinds of people that have documented this. I don't know whether you've seen any of Jerry Rifkin's productions or not. But Tom Hartman also. Now, if
all right, we can't do the now because we're running out of time. George?
Yes, I have. In fact, we had Jeremy Rifkin speak at MATC about 8 years ago. There's an excellent book on that subject by James Hansen called Storms of My Grandchildren. Came out about 3 years ago, and it examines what the impacts will be for future generations and what our responsibilities are to future generations. He calls it intergenerational justice. And I think it gets right down to the moral and the humane values to which the United States subscribes and which we need to show leadership in, and not just in our own country, but around the world.
Thank you, George, very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
George Stone, Instructor of Natural Science at the Milwaukee Area Technical College, and he's co-founder and chair of the Green Energy Summit in Milwaukee. They'll be celebrating their 10th year of summits in March. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to Brett Jaspers for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. I will not be here tomorrow. We've been doing this Ulster Project for years where Catholic and Protestant teens come from Belfast to be here for a month. And so one of the counselors will be staying with us. So I will be otherwise occupied tomorrow. But John Munson will be here. Wonderful, John. And I'll be with you again on Monday. So keep listening. Great conversations ahead.